11 o'clock in this very room. Dr. Ross is the teacher of that class. He's been the teacher for about
42.
Where have I been? Excuse me. 42 years.
Started when I was a teenager.
Yeah. You were like three, right? Normally, Dr. Ross teaches, but tonight we turn it around and you get to ask questions. So we hope you brought some good, tough, non-politically correct questions. That microphone back there is for all of you. And there's going to be a lineup over there. And Dave is the gatekeeper of the microphone, so you got to treat him nicely. I understand he does take bribes. A couple of rules. You can ask as many questions as you like to ask, but we ask that if you have more than one question, please go to the back of the line and go through the line again. That way everybody has a chance to ask whatever questions they have. We take questions on science, theology, the Bible, anything like that. I've never heard Dr. Ross say, I don't know, so see what you can do. I'd like to introduce Dr. Ross. Dr. Ross is founder and president of Reasons to Believe, which is a sort of a Christian think tank. It tries to integrate science and the Bible. And the idea is that if we are worshiping the God of the Bible, and he really did create the world around us, then the record of nature and the record that the Bible give us should agree, and they do. And he's the author of 17 books, most of which are over there on the book table. Say hello to Colleen. Colleen will sell you a book.
She doesn't accept bribes.
She does not accept bribes. Dr. Ross has a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto. He has a BA in physics from the University of British Columbia. And if you are a little shy to go to the mic and you have a burning question, write it on a piece of paper and slip it to Dave or to myself, and I'll be glad to ask it for you. We want to make sure that you get your questions answered. Around 8 o'clock, we're going to go till 9. Around 8, we're going to have a drawing. There should be cards on your seat. If you fill those cards out and give us all your vital, pertinent, secret information, then we're going to do a drawing, and we're going to give away three resources here.
We don't sell your information.
We don't sell your information.
Or give it away.
We guard it with our life. Okay, we're going till 9 o'clock tonight, and I think I covered all the bases there. We do this about twice a year. We did. How many people were at the one yesterday? It was pretty cool. We had over 80 people. What's that? Over 80. 80. Oh, yeah, eight people. It was fabulous. It was very good. All right. Dr. Ross, would you open us in prayer?
Sure. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for this time that you've given us in each of our schedules. And Lord, I pray that you grant us freedom to explore our doubts, to raise questions, and to gain insight. In Jesus' name, amen.
Now, Dr. Ross, he's going to start talking about some recent scientific discoveries, but the real point of this is the microphone. So as soon as somebody gets up there, he'll stop talking and we'll get to the questions. So, Jay, go.
So, no, you can go. I mean, I just have all these discoveries in case things are really dead here.
Yeah. I mean, okay, this is where he's getting this stuff, okay, from astrobiology. Do you really want something out of this, or would you rather have a question?
Okay, well, yeah, I got this great one from astrobiology, but let me begin with a creature you're probably all aware of. It's the chameleon. And a research article just got published a few days ago. I tweeted about it on my Twitter site. But what they've discovered is, first of all, the chameleon has the longest tongue-to-body ratio of any animal. Its tongue length, if you don't count the tail, is equal to the length of its entire body. So, and you're talking, you know, I think, well, a typical chameleon is like 8 inches. This has got an 8-inch tongue. And if you ever think about these spring-loaded things and toys, that's basically what the chameleon tongue is like. It's all curled up inside of its mouth, and it has the ability to snap its tongue out. So it's all curled up, it snaps its tongue out, And they've known that about the chameleon for some time, that that's how it catches prey, with this incredibly long tongue that's spring-loaded, so it can just snap out really quickly. The brand new discovery is they're wondering, you know, why is this chameleon so consistent in being able to snag flying small prey? Because, you know, they figure it's got to aim that tongue just right. Well, they said it's got to do with the eyes. And this is something else that they explored a little while ago, is the fact that the chameleon has two eyes like we do, but they independently move. Ours kind of all focus, so we can get depth perception. But with a chameleon, the two eyes move independently, which allows the chameleon to do trigonometric parallax, which means it can actually track the flight of its prey. And so it can measure its velocity and its position and be able to nav it. A third thing that was just discovered is that the tongue has an incredible adhesive on it. It's got a special kind of mucus that we don't see in any other animal. And it's such that the chameleon only needs to get close to the flying insect, because this tongue tip is just so sticky that if it gets close, it's going to grab the fly or whatever insect that's trying to catch and is able to grab it. And yet, it's such that it was inside of its mouth, it doesn't cause the spring-loaded tongue to stick. And so they're now actually looking at the chemicals inside the mouth to see if there's some mechanism that allows it to have varied stickiness. Bottom line is a number of engineers are looking at this mucus that's on the tongue of the chameleon saying, we need to copy this, because this is an adhesive we could really use for industrial application. As one more example of where engineers are engaging zoologists to study not only animals but also plants to develop engineering breakthroughs. As one more example of how nature does it better than we do. And so if you want to have an engineering advance, just check out what's already been designed there by our creator. So I don't see anybody coming to the mic yet. We do have one. Okay. All right. Otherwise, I'll switch gears and talk about something quite different. Go ahead.
Well, you read from that magazine. I read from Mad Magazine sometimes.
I don't have any discoveries from Mad Magazine here. Sorry.
Maybe it's better we go with you. But I remember watching a video about this guy named Miller who did an experiment back in the 50s or 60s.
Yes, yes. Stanley
and,
Miller.
They were all excited because supposedly this primordial soup was able to form some amino acids, et cetera, and then they disproved it. Are they still trying to say that life sprung up out of a primordial soup, or are they saying that, like, you know, spontaneous species just occurred, speciation?
Well, what's interesting is the evolution that happened in Stanley Miller's career, because he made that discovery in 1953 when he was getting his Ph.D., and it was the flask experiment that you see in every high school biology textbook, where they have this flask, they put in some what they call primordial chemicals, and then they spark it, and out comes amino acids. That's the story you see in your high school textbooks. What they don't tell you in the high school textbooks is that they did get, I think, 4 or 5 amino acids, but the only one that came in at anywhere close to 1% abundance was glycine, the simplest of the amino acids. And in every run, glycine accounted for 95% of the amino acid content. Also, what they don't tell you is they ran the experiment over 200 times, and only one run did they get the amino acids. So they had 200 failures and one success. And also, they scrupulously kept oxygen out of the environment. Even the tiniest amount of oxygen, you get nothing. And so what happened during the 70s was the first recognition that this flask experiment is irrelevant to the origin of life. It's irrelevant because there's no way you're going to keep oxygen out of the early Earth's environment. And even if you could keep oxygen out, you wouldn't be able to keep the ultraviolet radiation out. Two things stop prebiotic chemistry from making amino acids: ultraviolet radiation and oxygen. Now, if you've got oxygen in the early Earth's atmosphere, you don't get amino acids. But if you don't have oxygen, there's no way to stop the ultraviolet radiation from coming through. because it's the oxygen that makes the ozone shield that blunts the arrival of ultraviolet radiation. The other thing is, at the time of life's origin on planet Earth, we have orders of magnitude more ultraviolet radiation streaming in from the sun. Right now, we got the minimum amount of ultraviolet radiation coming in from the sun. You want to know why God waited 4.5 billion years to create human beings? We're not very tolerant to ultraviolet radiation. Bacteria can take a lot more than we can. But at the time of the origin of life, if you don't have oxygen, the ultraviolet radiation stops the prebiotic chemistry. So since the late 1970s, there's been the recognition that there is no flask experiment done under real Earth conditions that can make the amino acids. The textbooks still need to be corrected. I mean, you know, a number of Christian organizations are saying we need to replace the biology textbooks. Our strategy at Reasons to Believe is basically to go to the high school teachers and say, your biology textbook is outstanding except for two parts, the origin of life and the origin of human beings. But we have two books that we can give you to supplement your textbook. So we're not trying to replace the high school textbooks. We want to supplement them. And it's working well because our book on the origins of life got a really strong endorsement from one of the world's leading origin of life researchers, who himself is an atheist. In fact, he wrote a review of our book in Origins of Life in the Biosphere. And you can read that and just see what he said about our book. Bottom line, he said, ours is the most comprehensive, up-to-date, and scientifically accurate review of the origin of life problem. And he said there really is a problem. And I think I shared yesterday, he says, I like everything except about the book except the Jesus Christ part. So, but because of that, we're actually getting our book on origins of life into public schools.
Wow.
And similarly with the origin of life. But I told, if we were to take the strategy trying to replace the textbooks, we would get nowhere.
Did you touch on a second question about spontaneous
Well, there's several areas in the fossil record where there's a recognition that the standard evolutionary model has no answers. Number one is a transition from asexuality to sexuality. In fact, a paper just got published this about 2 weeks ago making the point that with asexual reproduction, you can get beneficial mutations. But with the beneficial mutations, you get way more deleterious mutations. Basically making the point, if you're talking asexual creatures, it will never improve. At best, it can stabilize a species, which raises a question, then how do you explain the transition from asexual reproduction to sexual reproduction? With sexual reproduction, you can devise some scenarios that are, in my opinion, not realistic. But at least you got a mechanism whereby you can weed out some of the deleterious mutations. With asexual reproduction, you don't have a weed out mechanism. And therefore, that transition is a huge barrier. And it's admitted in all the evolutionary biology textbooks that the transition from asexuality to sexuality has no naturalistic answer. Two other places that are probably the most dramatic, would be the Avalon explosion and the Cambrian explosion. And that refers to the first appearance of animals. And so for the first 3 billion years of life history on planet Earth, all you have are unicellular life forms or colonies of unicellular life forms. You don't have any megafauna. There aren't the big plants. There aren't the big animals. For obvious reason, until 580 million years ago, the oxygen content in our atmosphere was 1% or less, except for a brief period, 2.4 billion years ago, where it might have gotten as high as 2.5%. But it went up and went back down to less than 1%. With only 1% oxygen in the atmosphere, you can't have life that's more than unicellular. There isn't enough oxygen to support multicellular life. And what happened 580 million years ago, after a sequence of ice age events, you had what's called the Great Unconformity. You may have heard of that in your geology classes. And it's a chemical transformation of the world's oceans that led to the oxygen content in our atmosphere jumping from 1% to 8%. And it happened suddenly. It just went up like that. But the moment it hit 8%, we have large animals throughout the oceans of the Earth. And these are the abalone animals. Now, these animals are big. Some of them are as big as 2 meters across. However, these are animals without eyes. They don't have a mouth. There's no digestive tract. They don't have appendages. And for good reason, there's not enough oxygen to support animals with appendages, internal organs, eyes, and a digestive tract. And so these animals are called the abalone animals. They proliferated from 575 million years ago to 544 million years ago. And then there was a series of events that drove them all to extinction. But 1 million years later, you have another chemical transformation in the oceans that pushes the oxygen up to 10%. And so now we don't have any abalone animals. You're back down to the bacteria. But when it hits 10%, you get the Cambrian explosion. And this is the sudden appearance of animals with appendages, with eyes, with digestive tracts, with brains, even three compartment brains, like you see in some of the more advanced animals. Vertebrates show up as well as invertebrates, and they all show up at once at 543 million years ago. And as soon as the oxygen hit 10%, they're there. I'm bringing out a book next month, well, early September, which has a review of both the abalone and Cambrian explosion events, where I quote from several of the world's leading evolutionary biologists that have devoted their lives to researching both the abalone and Cambrian explosions. And what you see is consistently in all their published reviews, there is no naturalistic explanation for these events. And the more we study these two events, the more impossible it is to come up with a materialistic explanation. So these are a few places where evolutionary biologists are recognizing a naturalistic interpretation of the origin and the history of life is simply not possible. And this astrobiology journal I got here is making the point it doesn't work on Earth and it doesn't work anywhere else in the universe either. The same problems that we face here on Earth are ubiquitous to the universe.
Hi there. I've heard conflicting views on whether or not babies are saved. I'm sure you've heard that that view. I just wanted to know your any biblical passages that support that or discredit that.
Yeah, a good place to go would be John chapter 1, where we have John saying, God's light has gone out into the entire world. Now, if you want to know what John means by light, read his first epistle. First John, almost the entire book, is an exposition on God's light. And chapter 1, John says, God is light. And then he defines what that light is in the next three chapters. So chapters 2, 3, and 4 tell you that one component of God's light is love. A second component is life. A third component is truth. And so it's making the point in John 1, the Gospel of John, that God has communicated his life, his truth, and his love to every human being. Now, I would interpret that, that it literally implies to every human being, regardless of age, and regardless of handicaps or mental incapacities. And you say, well, does that actually go back into the womb? Well, we're told in Psalm 139 and Psalm 51 that indeed our spirituality goes back to the time we're conceived, which explains why Bible Christians look at life beginning at the time of conception. So Christians are okay with birth control, but they're not okay with abortion after the point of conception because of what the Bible says about the spirit. But what John 1 is telling us is that if you receive God's light, you proceed towards salvation. If you reject God's light, you proceed towards condemnation. The other thing you see in John 1 is that if you receive and believe the light that God gives you, he will work it out that you get more of that light. So you'll be blessed with more light. But there are children that only live to, say, 3 months of age. And there are many children that die inside the womb. Do they get God's light? Well, God is spirit. And when we're conceived, we become a spiritual being. And spirits can communicate with one another independent of the interfaces that make up our human body. In fact, we were having a meeting at our office today, and people were raising the question, do we need the brain to be conscious? And I said, well, if you actually look at the physics of the human brain, it's an interface. And so, you know, I've been around people that have experienced severe dementia. And what I notice with people with severe dementia, you can read the frustration on their faces when they're not able to communicate. And so the spirit is alive, but they're lacking the hardware in their brain to communicate with people in the outside world. But God doesn't need the hardware of our brains to communicate with us. So on that basis, I would argue there is no age of accountability. We're all accountable before a creator, because God has given each of us the capacity to receive God's light or to reject that light. Some practical examples of that. I mean, this church is a ministry to some people who are severely mentally retarded. We're talking people who are 50, 60 years of age, where they can't speak. And yet we've been around them long enough to recognize they have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Even though they can't read, they can't speak, but just the fact that we spend hours and hours with them, you can tell that there's a certain joy within their heart that can only be explained if they have a relationship with Jesus Christ. That's one piece of evidence that God doesn't need education or brain hardware to get his message through to us. And so I would argue we're all accountable. And moreover, there's a lot of evidence that when you receive God's light, he has a way of making sure you get more of that light. And so I tell people, hey, if you see somebody receiving the light, don't worry about what's going to happen to them. Things are going to move towards the conclusion that God intends. So in that sense, I would argue that being baptized doesn't save you. It's your faith that saves you, which baptism is a symbol.
Hugh, with all the kids that have died in childbirth and have been aborted, there's going to be a significant number of people in heaven who never actually lived on earth.
Well, a significant number who didn't make it outside the womb. And one reason why I think the doctrine you brought up is important is I hear people saying, well, I believe that anyone who dies before the age of accountability automatically goes to heaven. And what they mean by the age of accountability is where they have enough education that they can read the Bible, understand it, and respond to it. Well, that actually would say it's a good thing that we abort millions of children a year, because if we abort them, they automatically go to heaven. But we could apply that to a two-year-old. I mean, is it really ethical that we should, you know, kill our young infants and toddlers because they automatically go to heaven? And that's why I think it's so important to recognize what John was saying. Everyone receives God's light, regardless of intellect, mental capability, regardless of education, regardless of age after conception. They all receive that light. And the promise is, if you accept that light, you will be saved. If you reject it, you will not.
Hello, this is Dennis from Paradox. I think a few weeks back you mentioned something, I'm not sure if you did, in passing, about the fact that technology, we're about to reach our plateau in technology for the world. Is that something that you, if you could just point on that?
It wasn't in this issue of astrobiology, but the last issue where they made the point that regardless of your intellect, education, technology, there's a limit to how long any civilization anywhere in the universe can sustain high technology civilization. And so they were bandying around numbers, optimistically maybe a million years. Realistically, it's less than 10,000. And I would argue, if you're talking a level of technology that we've been manifesting since the end of World War II, a more realistic number is less than 2,000 years. Reasons why, you begin to consume resources. Another reason why, you need exceptional conditions on your planet in order to be able to sustain that level of technology. So, for example, to sustain the level of technology we have today, we need a high population. You're going to need a minimum of 1 billion human beings on the planet to sustain the level of technology we're enjoying today, and probably more, which means you have to have a very abundant, stable supply of food. And you notice that in human history. It's always been food surpluses that have launched technology. Because with food surpluses, you can afford to have individuals focus on engineering, science, mathematics, philosophy. If you've got a food shortage, everybody's got to work to feed themselves. And, you know, where you've got a food shortage, people are actually spending like 10 to 12 hours a day just getting their food for them and their families, which means they don't have time for engineering, science, philosophy, mathematics, etc., to sustain the technology. Now, in order to have the huge abundance of food that's necessary to sustain this kind of technology, you need to be on a planet where the climate is extremely stable over the entirety of the planet for a significant period of time, where the temperature, the surface of that planet, is optimal for sustaining the technology. What astronomers have come to recognize is that the universe will not permit that time window to be longer than about 10,000 years. And on our own planet, that window's been open for the last 9,000 years. And so we got 1,000 years, maybe a little bit more, and that's it. So if your theology is premillennial, then we need to, you know, get things taken care of quickly, because we're already down to a little more than 1,000 years left before that window will close. Well, it turns out that applies anywhere in the universe. You know, for one thing, the stars only reach the level of luminosity stability for a very tiny time window in their life history. To give you one point, the sun entered an extremely stable luminosity phase beginning 50,000 years ago, and it will end in 50,000 years. But in order to have a huge abundance of food, you have to be living in an ice age cycle. And with an ice age cycle, the maximum time you can sustain climate stability is about 10,000 years. And just to give you some perspective on this, our Earth is about 4.6 billion years old. We've had an ice age cycle for only the last 2.5 million years. There have been ice ages before, but they've not been cyclical. We've only had a cyclical one for the last 2.5 million years. And for most of that 2.5 million years, the cycle's been 41,000 years. With a 41,000-year cycle, the maximum stability time is 2,000 years. 800,000 years ago, we transitioned to a 100,000-year cycle. And the last ice age we had lasted from 135,000 years ago to 12,000 years ago was the longest of the ice ages we've had in the ice age cycle, which permitted an exceptionally long interglacial. This is the longest interglacial that's ever existed. But that enables us to have civilization. Now recognize, during that 10,000-year wide window, how long did it take us to reach the technology that we had at the end of World War II? It took 9,000 years. And that's going to apply to any civilization anywhere in the universe. It takes a long time to ramp up to that level of civilization. And by the time you get there, you've only got 1 or 2,000 years left maximum. And so with that recognition, yes. But the good news is, with that technology, we can take the good news of salvation of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world in a short period of time. We don't need tens of thousands of years. It can be done quickly.
Thank you. The Bible speaks of a talking snake, a body of water in Egypt, the Red Sea, kids killing 8-foot giants,
a virgin birth. It's mentioned a rapture, a seven-headed red dragon, and some ferocious monster that comes out of an ocean sea. That's bizarre literature, and could sound ridiculous to the natural world. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, let me deal with the last two you mentioned, because those are in the book of Revelation. And Revelation, as you kind of hinted, uses figures and symbols. But here's the key, because I believe most of the book of Revelation is intended to be written literally. However, where you know it's figurative is where it uses a symbol that's defined as a symbol elsewhere in the Bible. And just a little tip about reading the book of Revelation. John assumes that you're already deeply familiar with the other 65 books of the Bible. And so when you're reading Revelation, you're going to immediately recognize when he's using a symbol. And you can kind of figure it out, because if you take it literally, it doesn't make sense. So it talks about this world dictator coming out of the oceans, out of the seas. And the idea that you've got some human being living in the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, and he walks out and comes out in the land, that doesn't really make sense. So the question is, maybe John's using sea as a symbol. Well, you go back into the book of Isaiah and Jeremiah, and you discover sea is defined as a symbol for the unbelieving Gentile nations. So it's making the point that this Antichrist figure, this world dictator, is going to come out of a nation of unbelief. That's where we should expect him to come from. And when you talk about that seven-headed monster, it explicitly tells us in the text that this monster is a symbol. It actually tells you it's a symbol for seven kingdoms that will come up. So that kind of gives you a clue that it's not a real dragon.
Right.
Rather, it's a reference to these nations that will be present on the face of the earth at that time. Now, the other things you were talking about, your first one was...
Talking snake. David and Goliath.
Yeah, okay. And you'll see more examples of that, because you've got in Numbers a talking donkey. But what we notice is that the Bible tells us that God created two different species of intelligent life. One species that is constrained by the physics of the universe, referring to human beings. So we're subject to gravity, electromagnetism. We can't violate that. And we're subject to the space-time dimensions of the universe. But the Bible says God also created another species of intelligent life, namely angels, that are not subject to our physics. And so they live beyond the dimensions of the universe, but he's granted them the power to come into our dimensions. And so, for example, angelic beings can come into our realm and take any form they want. They can take the form of an animal. They can take the form of a flying saucer. They can take the form of a leprechaun. I mean, they can do all that. In fact, a lot of people have been deceived because they can take the form of your dead father. And they can communicate to you as if they are your dead father. They're not. They're simply taking that form. So the talking snake is a demon. It's a fallen angel. And likewise, the donkey is an angel speaking to Balaam. And so they can do that. Now, angels do not permanently dwell here. They come and they go. And they're just, you know, brief encounters.
A burning bush?
A burning bush? Okay. You got the burning bush. You got Jesus walking on the Sea of Galilee. You got the axe head that's in the bottom of a pool of water and floats to the top. These are all demonstrations that the creator of the universe can perform miracles within the laws of physics. He also has the power to perform miracles outside the laws of physics. So the axe head floating to the top violates the law of gravity. That's not a transformational miracle. It's a transcendent miracle. So it's God intervening beyond space and time. The parting of the Red Sea does not require a transcendent miracle. It's simply God manipulating the natural realm to, you know, save the Jews and take care of the Egyptian army. So the fact that we see these waters parting, we can imagine natural phenomena that would do that, hold the waters back. so these 3.5 million Jews can cross the Red Sea, and then just when the Egyptian army comes in, brings it back. The supernatural timing tells us it's a miracle.
A virgin birth?
Virgin birth. Well, this is another example of God transcending space and time. That text actually says that. It says the Holy Spirit came upon Mary and brought about the event of the virgin birth. And so it tells us explicitly there, this is a direct act of God from beyond space and time. And, you know, clear evidence of that is virgin births don't happen unless something beyond space and time intervenes.
Hugh, a real important part of this would be is, I guess, in somebody's life, if they have personally themselves not experienced a miracle, something that they see that violates the laws of physics, you would find it difficult to believe those things. I would just say in my own personal life, for my 30 years of being a believer, I've had two instances where I know absolutely that God intervened and changed the laws of physics for my benefit for a brief period of time. And because of that, obviously, these other miracles don't become a problem with me.
Right.
And so people in my life I know that haven't had those miracles, you know, unfortunately even some people in my family, right, I share my experiences, but my children look at me and say, well, that hasn't happened to me yet, you know, and so I have to say, well, you believe me as your dad, I'm not lying to you, but if you haven't seen that violation of physics, obviously, it would be understandable for someone to believe that. I tell my kids, obviously, if you want to experience those miracles, you need to enter the battle and share your faith more, because obviously, once you're sharing your faith, you're going to encounter somebody who doesn't want you to do that, you know. And so I encourage Christians who say, well, I haven't experienced beyond the laws of physics. I haven't seen that in my life. I tell them, you're probably just not on the battlefield. You need to get out there and share your faith. And I guarantee you, once you do that, you'll see that there is something beyond this space and time dimension.
You're anticipating my next book. I got it about one-third written. And it's basically, the working title is Always Be Ready. And it's making the point that if you will build 1 Peter 3:15 into your life as a believer in Jesus Christ, you will, on a regular basis, experience undeniable miracles. And if you're not familiar with the passage, it says, always be ready to give good reasons for the faith within you with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And if you will do that, you will see God supernaturally bringing people to you to hear those good reasons. I'll give you one quick example of this. This happened many years ago, but when I was full-time working here at the church, they had me organize people to return visits for people who came to the church, and we gave priority to people we thought were not yet believers. But I took this young man with me. He was brand new as a believer in Jesus Christ, and we visited this place, and it was up in the Altadena area. And we got there. It was incredibly dark. Well, first of all, we had knocked on about 20 doors. And everybody we tried to visit was not home. So we just left literature there, wrote them a little note, and went on. And it was 9:05. And, you know, I always said, we don't visit people after 9 o'clock. And he said, well, we got 5 minutes. Let's go for it. So we went to this one place, completely dark. And we went to the gate. And there was this German shepherd there. And the German shepherd, I mean, I opened up the gate, walked in, and the German shepherd escorted us about 200 yards, because it was a 5-acre place, to the front door of the place. And when we got to the front door, the man answered and said, how did you get here? And I said, well, your dog showed us the way. And he said, didn't you see the sign outside? And I said, we saw no sign. Well, it was a sign warning you that there was a trained attack dog on our premises. And this dog has never allowed anyone onto this property. Did he bark? And I said, nope, no barking. And didn't show his teeth. Nope, he just guided me straight to the door. And then he said, you must be from the church. And I said, yes, we are. And he said, well, come in. And he said, my wife, my three kids, and I have been praying for the last 90 minutes that God would send someone to us to tell us how we can all become Christians. And so he says, I think God sent you. He said, I know God sent you, because no one else would have ever gotten on this property. So I sat down and basically told them what the Christian life is all about and led them to commit their life to Jesus Christ. And afterwards, the man said, you know what really convinced me that we needed to listen? While you were sitting down, our dog was right beside you, staring at us, basically telling us, you better listen to this guy. And then he said, you probably don't believe what happened. We're going to show you how well-trained this dog is. And he says, we've got chickens in the back. So he gave a command to this German shepherd. The German shepherd ran out the back door, went into the chicken coop, got the three roosters out of the chicken coop, and went back into the chicken coop, and he would go to this one chicken, bump the chicken up, grab the egg, and bring the egg and drop it in a basket at the back door. And he did that with all the chickens and managed to keep the roosters out while he was doing all this, and we had this basket full of eggs. Says he does this every day. So, and he says his other job is making sure no one gets on the property. And he said, let me show you the sign. So as we left, the sign was as big as you can imagine. It was lit. And it says, something kept you from seeing that sign. Because, yeah, if we saw the sign, we wouldn't have gone on the property. So that's just one example of how God will supernaturally work. So go ahead.
I'm Jay Gupti. Thank you for having the class for us. It's beautiful. We love it. I have two questions. Recently we heard that there is they found a dead fish on Mars, on one of the creek down, and maybe you have a better feedback. And as well as I like to hear about our latest finding about gravity from LIGO.
Okay.
That would be beautiful if you can give us more feedback.
Sure. Well, first of all, I don't know about any dead fish on Mars or dead bacteria. Huh?
Sound like
the Inquirer. Yeah. I actually got some articles here with me making the point that there was no possibility of life ever existing on Mars, mainly because of the high ionic value of the minerals that exist on Mars. We do know there's water on Mars, not much. In the past, we knew that there was considerably more water, but the planet quickly dried out because it doesn't have plate tectonics. And what happens here on Earth is water and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will react and make carbonic acid, which makes carbonates. Well, that will actually suck all the water and carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And that's what happened to Mars. There was a time when it was warm and wet, but this carbonate cycle basically leached all the carbon dioxide and water out of the atmosphere very quickly. And for that reason, Mars has been cold and dry for the last 4 billion years. But an article just published a week ago is making the point that they've now established that there is these high valence ions in the chemistry of the surface of Mars. And it says even if you've got water, these high valence ions guarantee that no kind of life can survive there. So, and then the other thing that's been recently discovered is Mars has 60 times the quantity of sulfur on its surface that the Earth does. And that huge abundance of sulfur, if ever makes contact with water, makes sulfuric acid. And life doesn't handle sulfuric acid very well. By the way, sulfuric acid is something we're finding to be quite common on Earth-like planets. I mean, for example, if you were to visit Venus and descend in the atmosphere of Venus, you'd be killed very quickly by the sulfuric acid that's pervasive in the atmosphere of Venus. We all know it's really hot on the surface of Venus, but the sulfuric acid will get you first before the heat will. So, and that's one of the rare things about planet Earth. We're extremely sulfur poor compared to other bodies in the universe. Now, you need sulfur for life, but you only want a little bit of sulfur. You don't want the normal amount of sulfur. Now, having said all that, I do think inevitably we will find the remains of life on Mars. But it's not going to be Martian life. It's going to be Earth-transported life. Earth has infected the entire solar system with its life. Life is so abundant on planet Earth that when a large meteorite strikes the Earth, say something that's bigger than 1 ton, it causes Earth's soil to be exported throughout the solar system. and 1 ton of Earth's soil has 1/100 quadrillion bacteria in it. And so that's on the moon. It's on the moons of Mars moons of Jupiter. It's on the surface of Mars. However, friends of mine have calculated that the amount of Earth's soil on Mars adds up to only 200 pounds for every 100 square kilometers. So it's a very thin layer of Earth dust that's on the surface of Mars. So it's going to be quite challenging to find the destroyed bacteria that came from Earth. And that's what you're going to see. You won't see live bacteria, but you'll see the remains of bacteria on the surface of Mars. But you can go on our reasons.org website. You'll see an article that I've written on the moon, why we need to go back to the moon. Because on the moon, the quantity of Earth's soil is 20,000 kilograms for every 100 square kilometers. So it's a much thicker layer of Earth-transported material that's on the surface of the moon. You say, why didn't the Apollo astronauts bring some of that back? Their mission was to recover pristine lunar rocks. So a few years ago, I spoke at NASA Houston and say, we need to go back to the moon with a different mission, to recover the Earth-transported soil. For the following reason, Earth's geology is so aggressive, it's destroyed the fossils of Earth's first life. But the moon has virtually no geology. The fossils of Earth's first life are present in pristine, undisturbed form on the surface of the moon. We can go back to the moon and we can determine who's got the right origin of life model, the atheists or the theists. And as I shared with the Houston NASA scientists, last time I checked, if you add up all the atheists in the United States and all the theists, it's 100% of the taxpayer base. So everybody should be excited about going back to the moon, recovering these fossils, and seeing who got it right. And so we've written exactly what the atheists predict we're going to find and what the theists predict we're going to find. Radically different models. We can go to the moon and see who got it right. And incidentally, it can all be done without sending people. Relatively cheap machines, we're talking just a few million dollars, can actually recover those fossils and bring them back to us for analysis.
Second part of his question, just really shortly, is the latest gravity wave discovery.
Oh, the LIGO thing. Yeah, I'll be short on that because you can go to my Facebook page, and I've got a nice brief thing there on what's so exciting about the second LIGO find. You know, back in February, they announced that they had found the first gravity waves from the LIGO detector, from two big black holes merging together. But what got announced just a couple of weeks ago was an event that happened here in America on Christmas Day. So it was like God giving us a Christmas present. In Europe, it was the 26th, but here it was the 25th. Right. And these were two smaller black holes that merged, but they were much closer to the Earth than the event that was announced in February. So close, they were able to see 55 orbits of the two black holes, the gravity waves from the last 55 orbits before they merge. And that's what the theory of general relativity predicts, that if you've got two black holes orbiting one another, because of general relativity, those orbits will decay, and they'll get closer and closer to one another. As they get closer and closer, they spin much, much faster, and eventually they merge, and you get a really big gravity wave burst. But they actually saw the last 55 orbits. And this ranks as by far the strongest test of general relativity and the strong gravity wheel case. And so I explain the significance of that, because that actually establishes that there must be a God beyond space and time that created space and time. The theory of general relativity is the foundation of the space-time theorems. So what happened, what was announced 10 days ago, is huge for buttressing the biblical model of cosmic creation. But you can read about it on our website.
Can I squeeze a quick question? Why is it so important to understand the gravity from outer space? Why is it so important? I hear a lot of questions. I'm sorry.
Well, here's why it's important. You can go back to 1970 when Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose published the first of the space-time theorems. And what the theorem basically says, if the universe contains mass, and as I look out at each one of you, you're all individually proof that the universe contains mass. Okay? No one questions that. The second condition, does general relativity reliably describe the movements of the bodies in the universe under all conditions? And that's where this legal measurement was significant. Now, for several decades, we've known that general relativity reliably describes the movements of bodies in the universe in the weak gravitational field case. And the presumption was, well, if it does so well in the weak gravitational case, it must do it in the strong gravitational case. Confidence was, in the weak gravitational case, we've proven the reliability of general relativity to 15 places of the decimal. So that's a remarkable confirmation. But there were a few physicists saying, we got to do it in the strong gravitational field case. Well, now we've got two instances where we confirm general relativity in the strong gravitational field case. But the paper that came out 10 days ago offers a test that's 10 times more definitive than the one we had in February. So what happened 10 days ago is a really big deal. And more are coming, because we didn't know that we were going to have black holes that small merging this close. And given that we found them that small, there's very good reason to believe there are thousands of these. In fact, with the new upgrade of LIGO that's coming within 18 months, they're predicting they'll see one of these events every day. So this should be, we're looking at an exciting time. So take good care of your health, because we're looking at some really exciting discoveries.
We're going to take one more question before we do our drawing. So if you have not filled out your card, please do. And Dave will be happy to come. Dave will volunteer to come and get the cards and bring them to me, and we'll randomly pick them. So take the next few minutes to do that, if you would, please.
Wow, how come this isn't turning?
You broke it.
It's too tight. Okay. So mechanical. I've been reading a book on transhumanism.
Yes.
And what is it? Homo sapiens 2.0 and all that.
Right, right.
What is that? Can you expound upon what that is?
Yeah, transhumanism is basically artificial intelligence. It's a goal to build a supercomputer that is so powerful it manifests all the capabilities of human consciousness and beyond. And there are actually people speculating that our technological development of these supercomputers is going to lead to a species of artificially intelligent machines that will replace us, and that we're going to go extinct, and the Earth is going to be inhabited by these supercomputers that can reproduce.
Matrix.
Now, I've got 50 books in my office on the search for a natural explanation of consciousness. Every one of the books basically says, we looked here, it doesn't work. We looked here, it doesn't work. And it's led to a famous quote about artificial intelligence, that we're close to a breakthrough. We're within 10 years of building an artificially intelligent machine, and we'll always will be 10 years away from building an artificially intelligent machine.
Why is that?
Okay. And what they're recognizing is that what we see just manifested in the human brain is not just hardware, but software. And it's not just software, there's a programmer. And that's the limitation in artificial intelligence. We can actually build a machine that's so intelligent it can write its own software and correct its own errors in that software, but they're not able to duplicate the operation of the programmer. That's the missing ingredient. And they're not able to come up with a machine that's conscious. Now, they're fooling themselves, because they are building machines that can manifest emotion. But there's no free will in the emotion. It's programmed. So, for example, I could program my computer where I get up in the morning, it tells me, I love you. But it's probably not going to have the same impact on me as if my wife wakes up in the morning and says, I love you. Or for that matter, if my dog comes and wags its tail to me in the morning. And they've not been able to build an artificially intelligent machine that in any way manifests free will capability. But we are building machines that can store more memory than we can. Well, the other thing they've not been able to do is build a machine that has the capability of the human brain in the context of the volume of our head. And so there's no machine that we've built yet that comes even close to manifesting the hardware capability of the human brain.
Lots of power, lots of air conditioning.
Right.
They're also talking about gene splicing with animals.
Yes.
Because of, you know, like certain animals can see infrared. Certain animals can have better hearing. Genetically engineering the next level of human being.
Well, there's a whole lot of literature on that very point. Can we genetically engineer human beings to make a superhuman? Mm-hmm. And what that research is revealing, you can get certain extra capabilities, but everyone comes at a cost. And so that literature is basically revealing to us we are at the epitome of design. Now, what these efforts are telling us is that the human body is filled with trade-offs. So, for example, we can't run as fast as a cheetah. But unlike a cheetah, we can sit for 8 hours a day, or we can stand for 8 hours a day, or walk for 8 hours a day, or run for 8 hours a day. No non-human animal can do that. And it's because we have a skeletal structure that allows us to do each of those things well enough. But there are creatures that can run faster than we can. And there are creatures that can do each of those things better than we can, but we're able to do them all. No other creature can do them all. And so sitting is natural for us. It's not natural for other animals.
So you don't think that they can splice, like...
Oh, they can do all that, but what you're doing is basically altering the trade-offs. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I think it's actually possible we can make a human that can run faster than the fastest humans on the planet today, but they won't be able to run marathons. They'll only be able to do sprints. And likewise, that's what's interesting in terms of humans, is that we can outrun any other species of life on the planet if we're talking endurance. And so, yeah, their animals are stronger than us and faster than us, but none that can endure as well as we can. So, yeah.
The most famous trick is taking the glow-in-the-dark gene out of a jellyfish and sticking it in every species. That's about the most successful thing that's done, I think.
Right, right.
So if you want something to glow in the dark, you can do that. That's about it. They got sheep. So, like, you can go online, they got sheep that glow in the dark.
But you know what all this research is revealing to us is how amazingly designed the human body is for its ability to exist in a low-technology environment and a high-technology environment. Some of the papers are reading say, this is what's something we didn't expect, is that God designed the human body, and so they didn't use the word God, but they said the human body is designed in such a way that it can function optimally without technology, and it can also function optimally with technology. So, for example, the dexterity you see in the human hand, it's not necessary for a hunter-gathering environment. But here you have, for thousands of years, the dexterity of the human hand that can type 100 words a minute or play a Liszt piano concerto. And so it lasted throughout that entire period of time without application. But it's like the Creator knew we would eventually develop a technology where we could use that extra dexterity.
Complex math in our brain would be the most striking comparison also.
Yes, the fact that our brain can map so well. By the way, there's a paper coming out, it has been published, making the point that with GPS, we're seeing humans losing their brain ability to map geography. Well, but they've actually seen this in people in their 20s and their teens. The hippocampus region in the brain that's actually works to do geographical mapping is getting smaller.
Shrinks away.
It's shrinking away. And it's making the point that, like with every bit of our anatomy, if you don't use it, you lose it. And so GPS is actually shrinking our brains, or at least one part of our brains.
All right, Dave, you got some cards for us?
Last call. 1, 2, 3.
Great. Thank you so much.
Can I use it for my benefit?
All right, here's how this is going to work. We're going to draw some names out of this box randomly, and the first person that gets drawn gets choice of these three fine products here. The first one is The Great Debate, which is a DVD of Hugh Ross and atheist Victor Stenger. The second is Fuzz Rana's latest book. Fuzz Rana is the biologist on staff at Reasons to Believe. It's called Dinosaur Blood and the Age of the Earth.
Recent movements in culture and politics have started to spread secularism and globalism and atheism and environmentalism. And I have some friends that were brought up as believers like me who became atheists sometime after, maybe in the last 20 years, sometime after they became very, very attached to being environmentalists. And now I'm starting to see that secularism has got something to do with that. And I'm beginning to wonder if all of those are kind of intertwined and you see a connection there, and if there's a connection with anything else that's going on in you know, our culture all over the world that's causing all of this.
Well, I see both good and bad. For example, in the environmental literature, you can spot a religious fervor amongst some of the authors. But some of them are not coming from that perspective. And I would argue, in fact, as I've dealt with environmentalists that are pushing a non-theistic agenda, I say, you know, the first place you see an environmental agenda is in the book of Job. Read Job 37, 38, and 39. In fact, I would argue, even though that's the oldest book of the Bible, it's still the best counsel on how we're to environmentally care for the planet. And that's a good place to go, but it also helps us resolve the political tension we see in the environmental movement. The political tension is you've got one group saying, you know, we're damaging the environment, and the only way to fix it is to legislate draconian economic sacrifices. Okay, so you got one side saying that. You got the other side saying, you know, people are selfish. We're not going to be able to enforce that. And even if we in America were to decide we're not going to drive automobiles anymore and we're not going to have steel factories anymore, the rest of the world is going to drive cars. So, you know, how do we legislate the whole world? And even if we could, wouldn't people cheat? And so they make the point this is unenforceable. Moreover, they say ruining the economy doesn't really help us take better care of the environment, because now we've got less resources to take care of the environment. Now, what you see in Job 37, 38, and 39 is that God has already provided us with solutions to our environmental responsibility. That's one thing you see right in Genesis 1. God gave the command to Adam and Eve, I'm putting you in charge of the planet and all of its resources. Manage it for your personal benefit and the benefit of all life. And you see that not only explicated in three whole chapters in the book of Job. And so we're to care for the planet with all life in mind. But the promise is, God speaks and says, I provided you with solutions that will simultaneously be for the benefit of all non-human life and human life, which tells me God has provided solutions that are going to be maximally economic and maximally ethical. And if we come up with those solutions, you're going to get both sides voting for it. So it's one way to relieve the political tension. If I can provide you with a solution that's going to boost the economy and simultaneously help all the rest of life on planet Earth, who's going to vote against it? And what's interesting is the book of Job, the oldest book in the Bible, is filled with examples that we can institute that will help solve our global warming problem right now. We need to take counsel from that book of Job. And one of the things that, you know, notice chapter 37 of the book of Job basically says, target precipitation. And the problem with the environmental movement is they're targeting temperature. It's basically encouraging us, we need to target precipitation. And when you get in chapter 37, is God declaring, I've given you an amazing precipitation environment on planet Earth. Making the point, in fact, if you look in Job 37 and the first half of Job 38, we did this exercise in the paradoxes class here on Sunday morning. You find 16 different kinds of precipitation. And basically God is saying, I gave you an optimal environment for precipitation. Keep it that way. The truth is, we haven't. In the last 2,000 years, we've made the Sahara Desert 10 times bigger than what it was in the days of the Roman Empire. Today, the Sahara Desert is bigger than the whole continent of Australia. There was a time when it was just one-tenth the size. And that was just 2,000 years ago. The Gobi Desert is 4 times bigger than what it was. Well, if we were to shrink the Gobi and Sahara Desert back to its original state, you would be taking huge quantities of greenhouse gases of the atmosphere, because that's what plants do. They take carbon dioxide and water vapor out of the atmosphere. And those are the two most significant greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And if you read Roman history, what we now call the Sahara Desert, in the days of the Roman Empire, fed the Roman Empire. That's where they grew all their grain. Well, now nothing grows there. And so if you made it a grain-growing area again, you'd be providing income for all those Africans, and you'd be feeding people, and you'd be pulling greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Everybody wins. Moreover, you would change the rainfall patterns. The rainfall in that part of the world would double or triple. And so by sustaining the precipitation the way God gave it to us, we're going to be able to resolve a lot of our problems. That's just one example. I got a book over there called Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. I give you several examples. But the things that people are overlooking, you know, like the restoration of the whales. If we were to bring the whales back to where they were 300 years ago, it'd be one of the best things we could do to sustain climate stability. And it would restore the fish stocks at the same time. Everybody wins. So look for the win-wins. Don't look for the choice between a rock and a hard place. They're there. God put them there.
Hi. Go ahead. I want to ask about natural disasters, you know, like the tsunami, earthquake, and so forth, where 100,000 people perished, believers, non-believers. I read all the scientific explanation of why it happened. I'm just wondering, is there a biblical reason for why? Is it a random thing, or does God have his hand on it, or the people who died, is their time is up?
Well, Jesus addressed this in the Gospels and basically said it's the way things are. These natural disasters will happen. And a short answer to your question is it's because of gravity, electromagnetism, and thermodynamics. If you've got those laws of physics, you're going to have earthquakes. You're going to have hurricanes. You're going to have tornadoes. You're going to have forest and grass fires. And I've got a book over there called More Than a Theory, where I got a couple of chapters on natural disasters. And I wrote that because I'm trying to correct what I believe to be a theological mistake by Christians, where they begin to call these things natural evil. My claim is there's nothing evil about these disasters, because if we look at each one, we can determine that each one is at the optimal level. So, for example, if we had fewer forest fires, life would be more miserable for human beings. If we had more, it would be worse. The number of grass and forest fires we have is at the best possible level. You can make the same argument for hurricanes, earthquakes. So a lot of what I do in the book is show you the benefit of these disasters. Forests and grass fires put charcoal back into the soil. They allow the soil to absorb water. And we've done experiments where you prevent fires and it harms the vegetation. You need to have these forests and grass fires on a regular basis. And likewise with hurricanes. hurricanes act as a thermostat for the planet, and so it's important that we cool the hot spots on the planet. Otherwise, it's devastating for the fish stocks and those parts of the ocean. Moreover, hurricanes bring rainfall onto dry parts of the land masses, and they bring chlorophyll into the seashores. And what we realize is we're living on a planet where we've got the optimal number of hurricanes and the optimal intensity level of hurricanes. Now, Jesus also made the comment, these things are part of the natural order, but you need to be wise. Don't build your house on the sand. Windstorms are going to come. And, you know, what's interesting is that the Native Americans recognize that the east coast of Florida is not a safe place to live. And so the Indians in Florida basically kept away from the east coast. Now what we do is we send all of our retired citizens to live in mobile homes on the beach facing the east. And we wonder why their homes are destroyed and so many of them get killed in hurricanes. Well, we basically put them in houses built on the sand. Not a wise thing to do. And, you know, I think California is a good example of this. We know this is earthquake country. There's a reason why our homes cost twice as much as homes, say, in North Carolina, because there's about twice as much lumber in our homes. And the structures, I mean, we don't allow big spans. It's all designed for the fact that, hey, if you build a house in California with modern-day standards, it's built to withstand a magnitude 7 earthquake. And if you've got the money, you can build one that can withstand a magnitude 8. However, there's vast portions of North America where you're basically living in homes that are built on sand. For example, the rate risk of earthquake damage in Seattle is far higher than it is in Los Angeles. But the building codes in Seattle are such that homes get destroyed in a magnitude 6, let alone the magnitude 9s that they're at risk of getting. For all of you living here in Southern California, one thing I can assure you with, this state of ours is filled with so many faults, both physical and other kinds, but filled with so many faults that about the biggest earthquake we can get is a magnitude 8. However, in Missouri, you can get magnitude 9s. In Oregon and Washington, you can get magnitude 9s. And their building codes are not ready for. They're living in houses built on sand. Now, another question that comes up here, well, if God knows all this, why did he make a universe with gravity, electromagnetism, and thermodynamics? I mean, it's true. The angels don't suffer from earthquakes. You know, if God made us a different physical realm, we wouldn't have these problems. Well, this is why I wrote the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, where I explain why it's so important we live right now in a universe with gravity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism. It's because of those laws of physics that God can rapidly and efficiently eradicate evil and suffering. And the promise we see in the Bible is once evil and suffering are permanently eradicated, then this universe will be replaced with a brand new realm with radically different physics. And if you read Revelation 21 and 22, it's a realm where there's no gravity, no electromagnetism, and no thermodynamics. It won't be necessary because evil and suffering will no longer be possible with the free will agent beings that are living there. And I explain why it's crucial we first be exposed to evil and suffering in order that our free will can be enhanced to greater capability and yet not run the risk that we would ever introduce through our free will evil and suffering. And basically requires that we first be exposed to the greatest possible challenge in the context of evil. And I shared briefly this yesterday when we did the Skeptics Forum. A good analogy is to think of someone who has a PhD. If you got a PhD, you're granted a piece of paper that guarantees that never again will you be tested for competency in that discipline. Based on the recognition, you've already been subjected to the most difficult tests, so there's no need for another test. Likewise, in this universe, God is subjecting us to the most difficult tests. And if you pass that test, then there is no possibility for evil and suffering. Nobody gets to the new creation without first being subjected to the most difficult test. Yeah, go ahead. Well, first of all, I think it's important to relay to them Jesus' words, because people asked Jesus, said, you know, the Tower of Siloam fell, and dozens of people were killed by the falling of the Tower of Siloam. Why did that happen? First thing you share with them is, it's not because of their sin. These things happen. Buildings aren't built right. Laws of physics are going to cause these things. So it says, don't draw the wrong conclusion. The reason why they died is because they were evil people. As you said yourself, this happens to the good and it happens to the evil. Everyone experiences these things. But Jesus also said you can take preparations. But even if you take preparations, there's still going to be consequences. Now, does God have the power to rescue us from those situations? Yes, he does. And he does intervene. I've had that experience in my own family, because I had two cousins that were working in the World Trade Center on September 11th. And one of them got sent on a business trip to Florida the day before the Twin Towers were destroyed. The other one was ill that day and called in and said, I can't come into work. Both of them survived. Now, being a believer, I believe God worked out circumstances, so, and that was what people notice, is that if it had happened on a normal day, the death toll would have been much higher. But it happened on a day when, quote, fortunately, a lot of people weren't there to work. Okay, is that a sheer accident that a whole bunch of people didn't work? So people were saved. Now you say, well, why didn't God save everybody? That's the next question that comes up. Well, God has the power to save every human being from every natural catastrophe. But if he were to do that, and this is a big chunk of my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, if he were to act that way, then gravity, thermodynamics, and electromagnetism in the space-time dimensions would not have the power to restrain sin and evil. So in order for sin and evil and suffering to be conquered, it's crucial that most of the time we be exposed to those consequences. And keep in mind, it's not just natural disaster. We're suffering the consequences of gravity, thermodynamics, and electromagnetism every minute of our life. I mean, look around you. We're all decaying. And so a natural disaster can bring about decay quickly, but the truth is, every minute of our life, we're experiencing that decay. But what I explain in my book is that decay is exactly what's needed to motivate us to depart from evil and to pursue virtue, and to recognize the only way that's going to be working is if we get God's help. Because I remember my professors when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto. There were 13 of us in the freshman class, and they told us, you 13 are the cream of Canada's crop. We know you're very bright, and you know you're prepared to work really hard. But one thing we promise you, if you do not get help from us, you will not get your doctorate. This program is too challenging for you to pass without our help. Well, 7 of the 13 did not get their PhDs. And a lot of it was because they didn't get the help that was being offered by the professors. Same thing's true of the Christian faith. God is saying, you're not up to the challenge. You cannot take on Satan and his demons. They will defeat you unless I help you, and I'm here to help. And if you take my help, I guarantee you will pass that test. Now, my professors didn't give me a guarantee that if I took their help, I would pass. God gives us a guarantee.
Can I say something on that, Hugh?
Sure.
I think what God wants from all of us more than anything is a relationship. He wants a relationship with us. If everything on this planet went easily and we had no problems, the last person we would think about would be God. So God often uses these challenges as a reminder that he's there, that he loves us through those things, despite those things, and that even our life is not as important as the relationship that we have with him. So it's really a way of him showing us what the priorities are. And so I think the problem of evil and suffering is the biggest challenge to the Christian worldview. It's the hardest question to answer. But it has to do with him showing us what the priorities are. He loves us despite these things that happen, because it points us to him. It points us to him in the sense that we know what the priorities are. We know that he and his love are more important than any of these things that we have on planet Earth. And a lot of times when these kind of things happen, it's an opportunity for us to be there for other people. It's an opportunity for us to comfort them. We can be Christ on earth in helping and comforting other people.
Yeah, and I think the most challenging thing is when people suffer a natural consequence, whether it be disease, cancer, a natural disaster, when they're in their youth. And I think it's really important to comfort people with Isaiah 58. Because Isaiah 58 basically is that chapter which says, let me explain to you why good people die young. And that, to me, is the biggest challenge, is when, like, there's a couple in this church. They lost their son to a very horrible traffic accident. And they said, why did this happen? Why did God allow it to happen? Isaiah 58 says, people ponder why people who are righteous die in their early years. He says, God is sovereign. God knows the future, and he knows what lies ahead in that person's life. And if he sees that there's going to be trauma and turmoil and torment in that person's life, he has the power to take that person home early. And he will do that. And I've been able to share that with people who have lost loved ones in their early years. And they can draw great comfort from that, realizing God knew the future. And a good analogy for that is, this happened when I was an undergraduate. At the University of British Columbia, your final exam was always a 3-hour exam that would take you about 5 hours to finish. And so it was an incredibly traumatic situation. I mean, you just sat there writing as fast as you could, trying to remember everything you need to remember, trying to run through the problems. And so I was sitting in this exam room, and the professor, after 1 hour of that 3-hour exam, took my paper away. And I was really upset. And he says, you're going to get the top grade. There's no need for you to spend any more torment here in this room. You can leave. So I think there's an analogy there that's effective. I mean, you know, this life here on earth isn't pleasant in the best of circumstances. And it's far better to be home with the Lord. And if that person's already got a secure relationship with the Lord. And that's what Paul said. My preference is to be home with the Lord, but I know I got a job to finish here on earth. And I'll just tell you one more story. Because my son, when he was 23, was jumped by a bunch of evil people and got stabbed 4 times. His friend got stabbed 8 times. His friend died. And my son almost died. But what happened was, this guy was just 22 years of age. He was the son of a senior pastor of a very large church. And the guy was preparing for a life of ministry. He was taken like that. However, I remember when my son was in the hospital 3 days after he'd been stabbed, 5 friends of the one that died came in to visit my son Joel. All 5 had walked away from the Lord. And so we sat there, and they kept asking questions. Why did this happen? So I got out this Bible and read the story of another young man heading for an incredible ministry that got snuffed out in his youth. And it's a story in the book of Acts of Stephen. How, you know, he was kind of the rising star in the church. And it looked like, you know, just as he was ready to take off, he got stoned to death. But I said, look what happened. There was another young man that was holding the clothes of the people who were stoning Stephen. He says, what happened to that young man? He wrote 13 books of the Bible. And so at that hospital bed, all five of those young men said, "We're coming back to the Lord." It says, our friend died, but he's passed a baton on to us. Just like Stephen took his ministry baton and put it in the hands of Saul. Likewise, this young man, Ryan, passed the baton and put it in the hands of these five young men. That's just a little bit of what can happen. Stephen was willing to die in order that there could be an Apostle Paul. And I don't think he realized what was going on. But the other thing I think is encouraging, notice when Stephen was being stoned to death, he saw a vision of Christ. And so he died in joy, knowing that Jesus was personally escorting him across the threshold of death. And I've seen that. There was a pastor here in the church, and he told me that he had been with 300 Christians who were lucid at the point of their death. He says, every single one said, I hear my name. I need to say goodbye. And he said, they died with a smile on their face. And he says, I got to go. He's telling me I need to go. And how they got a personal escort across the threshold of death. Now, he also said, I've been with dozens of people who were in a state of rebellion at the time of death and were lucid. It says, in every single case, they cursed God as they were dying and were rejoicing the fact that they were going to spend eternity in hell. They wanted to go to hell. So what that told me was this. People choose where they want to spend eternity. God doesn't send you to heaven or send you to hell. You get to choose. And he honors the choice that you make.
So, Dr. Ross, when we try to reconcile or match up the record of nature and historical records against what the Scripture says, we often focus on things like the Christmas star, for example. There's been lectures about that recently. But the events of the crucifixion and resurrection seem to not get too much study or treatment. People ask if the crucifixion was true, and of course we have plenty of evidence, circumstantial evidence, why it's true. But the events of the resurrection, I've heard very little corroborating evidence from the historical record. The resurrection. So, for example, to back up the claims of Matthew chapter 27, where it says that the dead were raised out of the tombs, and the rocks were split. There was a big earthquake. The curtain of the temple was torn. People noticed that these dead people had come to life and were walking around in Jerusalem, and that the guards and the centurions noticed this too, not just Jews.
Right.
I've looked and I have not found any record of that, you know, people saying, hey, people saw that there were, the tombs were opened, like Roman records, for example, and other records. Do those records exist?
Well, there are two that are contemporary. There's one by the Roman historian Tacitus. And so he wrote about about Christianity and what Christians believed. And you also have Josephus, who was an unbelieving Jew. He wrote in his book of history about the claims of Christianity. And both Tacitus and Josephus wrote about the person of Jesus. So they recognized that Jesus of Nazareth was a real individual who was crucified, and how their followers claimed he was raised bodily from the dead.
They were contemporaries,
right. Now, the other thing you notice is Paul writes about these 500-plus who are eyewitnesses to the resurrected Christ, and he says these people are still running around. Now, if what he said was utterly false, then his books wouldn't have developed the credibility that they got. And, you know, this is the problem. If you're going to write false history and people are around to say that didn't happen, your book is not going to last. The fact that the books of Paul did, last the test of time, they weren't refuted by his peers. And you actually see this in the book of Acts, where they got Peter and John performing this amazing miracle, and they said, we can't deny this event happened. He's running around in front of us. I think the other good piece of evidence is how do you explain half the population of Jerusalem becoming followers of Jesus Christ in just a few weeks? You know, to get that dramatic of an impact in that short of a period of time, it can't be based on things that aren't true.
There's no dispute that the circumstantial evidence is very strong.
Right.
But what I'm talking about is not Tacitus or Josephus saying, I've heard it said that his followers claim this.
Right.
But that this centurion said that he saw dead people walking around and the tombs were opened. There is no non-Jewish literature like that, is there?
Well, the problem is you don't have the manuscript weight that you have for the New Testament. And so, you know, the New Testament is the best attested book from ancient times. And you know, we do have evidence that it was contemporary to that period of time. And this is something historians point out. If you've got books that are making false claims to people who know other, you know, people who are actually there to realize that didn't really happen, it's not going to survive. And I shared yesterday how, you know, there were three French lawyers in the 19th century who were all atheist skeptics. And they said, we're going to prove the resurrection didn't happen. And we're going to prove it by using the same principles of evidence that we use in a court of law, because they're all trial lawyers. And they wound up writing a book where they said the historical evidence that Jesus, in fact, did rise bodily from the dead is stronger and more persuasive than the evidence that Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo. And their whole point, when they, you know, they published their book when there were people that were still alive who had fought in that battle. And so their point was, hey, we believe that Napoleon was defeated in Waterloo. Why do we doubt that Jesus was raised from the dead? And so we accept all kinds of historical facts without question. We actually believe there was a Julius Caesar. Well, the documentary evidence for the life of Julius Caesar is far weaker than the documentary evidence that Jesus of Nazareth lived and that the events recorded in the Gospels actually all happened as they were recorded. So if you believe in Julius Caesar and you believe that he invaded Gaul and defeated the Gauls, then you really have no basis for doubting the claims of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead.
The other text would also, we have a lot of writings of the early church fathers that were alive and contemporaries of those people, also the other document to look at.
Right.
There's a famous Japanese physicist. My phone's not working. I couldn't look up his name. His name begins with a capital M.
Oh, yeah. Michio Kaku.
Thank you. And I've seen a YouTube video where he claims that modern physics is in a real uproar because they can't come up with one equation. They have an equation for the big things in the universe, and they have an equation for the small things in the universe, but they can't balance the two out. Can you maybe comment on that a little bit?
Well, he's talking about the conundrum of trying to come up with a quantum gravity theory. Where we got general relativity, which is very effective at describing the universe on large scales, but it's not that effective on describing what happens inside the nucleus of an atom. Quantum mechanics can explain the small, but not the large. But every physicist that I know believes that there's a unifying principle between quantum mechanics and gravity. Now, to discover that unifying principle means you would need to duplicate the temperature conditions when the universe was the size of a quantum entity. The problem is we lack the technology and the finances to be able to do that kind of experiment. Now, we've done some of it. So, you know, the last 60 years has been one where we've been building more and more powerful particle accelerators. And what those particle accelerators are basically doing is duplicating the conditions of the universe when it was extremely young. And so now we've got a particle accelerator in France and Switzerland that's powerful enough to tell us what the universe was like when it was about a trillionth of a second old. However, to really answer the question of how we unify, because the unification of the gravitational force with a strong electroweak force happened when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. So we're never going to have a particle accelerator powerful enough to be able to experimentally demonstrate what happened during that era. And so, and then there have been attempts by theoreticians to build a quantum gravity, set of equations. And they've done that, but we have no way of determining whether they're correct or false. Now, where we're able to make some breakthroughs, we are seeing certain objects in the universe where the energy densities exceed what we see in our most powerful particle accelerators. And they're able to eliminate whole classes of quantum gravity models from contention. So we know some models that aren't correct, but there's still literally an uncountable number of models that could be correct.
So the frustration lives on somewhat.
The frustration lives on and will continue to live on. Now, there are physicists saying, well, we have figured out how the weak nuclear force and the electromagnetic force are unifying. We've got a complete theoretical and experimental understanding of that, thanks to particle accelerators. The next step is to actually show how the strong nuclear force unifies with the electroweak force. But that would require a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. The one in Switzerland and France is 17 miles long. So we need one 40 trillion miles long. And it was Alan Guth, the MIT physicist, who said that won't be funded until the Democrats control all branches of the government.
Hello. Hello, Dr. Ross. I have a question, really a point of clarification and understanding regarding the onset of sin and disobedience as it originally occurred in heaven with Lucifer, and what your position is on his banishment from heaven relative to the point where our universe was created. Because I've heard you said you say before in YouTube videos I've seen that our universe was created specifically for the efficient resolution of the problem of sin, and specifically, I guess, for our benefit. So I'm trying to understand, was Lucifer and the third of heaven's angels cast out before our universe was created or after? And if so, when were they, when in your estimation do you think they appeared here on earth?
Well, the Bible is silent on exactly when that rebellion occurred. Now, it is clear that it occurred before Adam and Eve were placed in the Garden of Eden. So, yeah, Satan was in a state of sin when he came into the garden. But exactly how much before that event the rebellion took place with Satan and a third of the angels, the Bible is silent. It could have been before God created the universe, or it could be after God created the universe. Now, there is a passage in Job 38:7, which talks about, you know, the stars, the morning stars, being witnesses to God laying down the foundations of the deep. And stars is a symbol that you see defined in both the New Testament and the Old Testament as being a reference to angels. So if that's the case, then it means that the angels were witnesses to God laying the foundations of the earth. That would tell us they'd been around for at least 4 billion years. But they may have been around even before that. Now, there's a split in the body of Christ on whether or not this could have happened before the universe or after the universe. So people who believe, that take what's called an Arminian perspective on theology, where it's basically free will and that God does not predetermine or predestinate, and they're saying, well, that would mean the universe would have to be created first, and then Satan and the rebellion took place, and God reacted. But those who take the doctrine that God predetermines and predestinates, and I think there's very good scriptures, especially those in Ephesians, that would say that. Other passages would say that God's works of redemption predate his works of creation, which means that if God knows the future and is predetermining the future, then why couldn't the rebellion of Satan take place before the creation of the universe? But I would argue, even from that perspective, it doesn't have to happen before. If God is really predetermining everything, then it doesn't matter at what point Satan chose to rebel. and therefore it doesn't matter when he was created. And I think that's one reason why God didn't tell us in the Bible. It's not necessary in order for us to theologically respond correctly to our circumstances to know exactly when this happened. Now, I'm sure a lot of us are going to want to know the answer when we get to the new creation. But the scriptures are silent on exactly when.
Were Lucifer and his angels specifically banished here? Because I remember reading in the Bible where Jesus spoke of seeing, witnessing Lucifer falling to the earth like a lightning bolt or like a falling star or something like that.
Yeah, there are many passages that talk about Satan being banished to the earth and crashing down to the earth. I have passages where it says that includes the demons as well. And when you look in the book of Revelation, it does refer to a time when these demons will come to the earth for a period of a few months. And so, but if you read the book of Ezekiel, it's like, well, maybe this happened before. And so is there one event where the demons are cast to the earth, or are there two events? I've heard some theologians say maybe three. And these are difficult passages. You know, people ask me, Hugh, do you actually comprehend all the chapters in the Bible? I say, I have not got the last eight chapters of Ezekiel figured out. So if you can help me with that, great. But I don't have that figured out. But I think that's true of any theologian. I mean, we got a PhD theologian over here, Travis Campbell, one of our visiting scholars. I think Travis would tell you, every research theologian would admit there are portions of the Bible we don't fully understand or comprehend, which is why we still need seminaries. I mean, if we understood everything, why have all these theologians being paid our good money? We could simply have them doing other things like science. but the truth is, we don't understand everything that's in the Bible. There really is need for ongoing research.
Yeah, I think that's also one of the keys for inspiration of the Bible. That a lay person without much knowledge can really gain benefit to benefit their life, and somebody who's been searching the scripture their whole life, can one day open up the book and still find something new, and the Holy Spirit reveals something. And that, to me, that's one of the reasons I point to for the inspiration of the scripture, along with fulfilled prophecy and historical accuracy, and we can go on. But that is one of the inspirational tests of the Bible is its unique ability to convey information.
Well, it's something was a factor when I was a teenager checking out the different religions. When I looked at the holy books and commentaries that undergirded the other religions, they were not content rich. I mean, to give one obvious example, the Quran is, in my opinion, quite vacuous in its content. There's not a whole lot of content there. You don't have to read it very many times to realize, I got everything this book is going to say. But when I picked up the Bible, I said, no matter how much I study this, I'm never going to exhaust its content. It's the most content-rich book I ever picked up. And it's like, this couldn't be written by mere humans. It had to be inspired by the one that did the deeds. Because how else do you explain this rather small book being so content-rich?
What did God do that created the Big Bang? Because what did he do?
Good question. And when you read the Bible, it actually tells us what he did to make the universe. It tells us in the Bible that God made the universe from that which we cannot detect. The universe that we can detect, the universe we can see, the universe that we can make contact with our senses, that came from something beyond which we can detect. What can we detect? We can detect matter. We can detect energy. We can detect space and time. The Bible tells us the universe came from something beyond matter, energy, space, and time. And in that context, the universe came, quote, out of nothing. It also tells us that when God created this universe, he created it as a very infinitesimally tiny volume, but it's expanding. And so we live in a universe that expands. 11 times in the Bible it tells us the universe expands. And that the laws that govern the universe, the laws of physics, they don't change. And that one of those laws is this pervasive law of decay, that everything in the universe is decaying. Paul writes that in Romans, the entire universe is subject to decay. Also tells us the universe will continue in that state until the full number that Jesus intends to save will be saved. Once that full number is reached, God's going to replace the universe with a brand new realm. So, yeah, the Bible talked about the Big Bang thousands of years ago.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay, so I had kind of a personal question along the lines of all of these questions that we have about the Bible and about how God does things and why he does things. In science, we have written records of how everyone does their experiments. We have to be able to tell each other how we did each experiment and got each result and everything. As a scientist, how frustrating is it to have this relationship with God where he won't tell us his methods and where he won't actually fully disclose? I mean, I'm guessing it must be incredibly humbling, but how do you kind of like mentally kind of come to terms with that, with the fact that he won't always tell us the answer?
Well, I was at Caltech for several years on their faculty, and I got to know a lot of these really famous scientists, Nobel laureates, but atheists. And so I said, what is it that gives you fulfillment in life? And they said, what really drives me to continue doing what I'm doing is the 20 seconds that I'm going to get where I make a phenomenal discovery and I have this euphoria. So I said, you mean you're living your whole life for 20 seconds of euphoria? I said, that's exactly right. Richard Feynman actually put that in writing, he says, there's nothing like that feeling, and it only lasts for a few seconds, but it's worth everything to have that few seconds of euphoria. Now, what drives that euphoria is making a discovery that no one has made before, and especially where the discovery has significant impact. So I think one reason why God doesn't tell us everything we want to know, he wants us to experience that euphoria of uncovering the wonder of what he created. And this is what kind of got to me about these scientists I knew at Caltech, is like, you're discovering what God did. You know, why not? There's a lot more euphoria in that thing than there is just saying, you know, I made this discovery. And that's something I personally experienced. People ask me, why did you leave Caltech and become a pastor at this relatively small church? It's like, I recognize that there's a thrill in discovering quasars that no one has found before. But it doesn't compare to leading someone to faith in Jesus Christ. Because a quasar is not going to last that long. After a few billion years, it's gone. But when you bring a human being to faith in Jesus Christ, that has eternal consequences. And there's a euphoria you experience when you do have that privilege of leading someone to Jesus Christ that's greater than the euphoria of discovering a galaxy or a quasar. You know, what I told myself is, you know, galaxies and quasars are basically nothing but hot gas. So... Some people are too, I understand.
It's 4 minutes to 9, and we have one person at the mic, and Andrea.
I'll make this.
That'll be the last two questions.
Okay. So you talked about Jesus, the end coming when everybody God intends to save will be saved. So I'm just wondering, if you said, if we believe life begins at conception, are there going to be people who did not get a chance to be born and never existed when God brings about the end of time? And what happens to them?
Well, what we see in Romans and in Revelation 7 is that God has a number that he is predetermined that will be with him in the new creation. And that once that number has been reached, he's going to replace this universe with a new realm.
Does he give that number or no?
He just tells us it's...
like, who is that?
Okay. The only hint we got...
I know.
No, it's in...
I missed something, that's all.
A couple of places where you can get a handle on that number. One is Revelation 7:9, where it says that the redeemed host will be from every tribe, nation, language, people, and it will be an uncountable number. Now, this is written in the first century A.D., and the Greeks had the most advanced mathematics system, but their numbering system stopped at 1 billion. So when it says uncountable, it means it's got to be in excess of a billion. So we're talking billions of humans minimum that are going to be redeemed. That's the lower limit. The upper limit could be higher. Okay. And then the point is it's going to include people from every tribe, nation, language, and people group. So there won't be any ethnic group that will be left out. And then Zechariah 13 gives us the measure of how many we're talking about for a particular ethnic group. And Zechariah 13 is addressing the Jewish kith and says there will come a time when one-third of the Jews in the world will recognize the one that they have pierced and they will repent. So that tells us it's going to be a third. Okay. Now, Jesus in the Gospels told us that there would never be a majority. But he also hinted it's going to be a large minority. So I'm thinking we're looking at something like a quarter to a third, somewhere in that neighborhood of people from every possible ethnic group that will actually be part of the redeemed hosts, which is why I believe that the minimum population in the new creation of human beings will be 50 billion. It may be more, but that's the minimum. So, and what also encourages me, you're going to see this in my book that I got coming out in early September, is I actually show you how close we are to reaching that uncountable number and that one-third from every ethnic group. I mean, we're incredibly close to making it happen. And
do you believe then that the end is coming soon?
Let me give you a quote from Ralph Winter, who is the founder of the U.S. Center for World Mission and used to be a participant here in our Paradoxes class. His comment was, Christians today who are committed to the Bible have enough resources in terms of people and of money and technology to fulfill the Great Commission in 5 years or less. All they lack is a motivation. He also wrote a research paper where he said, if evangelicals around the world would simply give 1% of their income to organizations that are committed to fulfilling the Great Commission, it would be fulfilled in 10 years. Now, he also wrote there that the actual amount of funding that's going to these different efforts is about 0.1%. So we're a factor of 10 away. But he says, hey, if we can go from 0.1% to 1%. But I remember having a dialogue with him and saying, you know, what you missed out of your paper is where that 1% comes from. It comes from people that are giving 20 to 30% of their income. They give to their church, but they also give to all these organizations that are committed to filling the Great Commission. Trying to challenge those people to give 10 times as much isn't going to work. It's greater than their total income. What we need to do is challenge the vast majority of evangelicals around the world who give nothing. And that's the missing factor. It is true that the vast majority give nothing for that effort. And so if we can get them to give something, we could see the Great Commission fulfilled quickly.
Thank you.
So
it's 1 minute after 9, but I promised Andrea I would get her question answered, so make it snappy.
I'm a teacher. I don't know how to do these. One thing I want to say, my name is Andrea Klink. I live locally, teacher. Special education, math, science. I appreciate what you said about someone passing away at an early age. A lot of people, my son came here, and last August he passed away. No cause, natural causes, nothing wrong. And there were a lot of people came to the service, and he loved the Lord, but there is something in his life that would have been really difficult. I mean, impossible for him to handle. And so I think that's why the Lord took him. Another thing, I think Richard Feynman discovered some things and then put them in the bottom drawer until somebody else discovered them. Because I read some of his books, and he said when people came in with a new discovery, he just drilled them with so many questions as if he already knew the answers. I don't know if you know anything about that. Yes, no?
That was pretty common with the Caltech scientists I've run around with. Mm-hmm. I mean, my office was pretty close to Fritz Zwicky's office. And, you know, he was in his 70s when I came there as a postdoc. And he'd always come into my office and say, yeah, that discovery, I knew that 40 years ago. So he took credit for virtually every discovery that was made in our astronomy department. So.
But my main topic is the old Earth versus new Earth, because most of the Christians that I know that are in leadership believe 7 days is 7 days. I guess it's really hard for me to, I mean, I trust them and I believe them, but having learned what I've learned here, it's kind of hard to, I don't know. I'd like to invite them here, but I know that they wouldn't come.
Well, they might, because I've had a lot of experience with addressing those kinds of audiences. And one thing I've learned is that when you're in front of an audience of young Earth creationists, you need to argue for your position with the Bible and nothing but the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I remember doing a debate in North Carolina, and there were 1,200 young Earth creationists in the debate. And I was debating a young Earth scientist. And my wife was in the audience. And they held the two of us who were going to debate one another in the green room. And we were there for 40 minutes. And we're just saying, what's going on? Well, after the debate, my wife told me, they brought three speakers up to prep the audience for the debate and basically said, our guy is going to argue for his position from the Bible because he gives priority to the Bible. When Dr. Ross gets up, he's going to argue from science because he believes science trumps the Bible. We believe the Bible trumps science. Now, I was not aware of any of this, and they were going to have me speak second, but they couldn't get the other person's stuff to work well, so I said, well, I'll speak first. So now, when you get the debate from the young Earth creations, they actually switched it. I actually spoke first, but they got me speaking second. But my entire talk was all Bible. Yeah. His entire talk was all science. It was exactly the opposite of how they prepped the audience. But what I was showing the audience was this. I know you all really have a high regard for the Bible. I do too. And like you, I believe in biblical inerrancy. But let me show you why biblical inerrancy is best defended from an old Earth perspective. Because I'm not just going to appeal to Genesis. I'm going to take you through the entire Bible. Mm. It's not enough to believe that the Bible is literal. We have to believe that it's literal and consistent. Because God's Word can't contradict God's Word. And basically show them that if you go through the entire Bible, the only way you can defend biblical inerrancy is from an old Earth perspective. But what really helped is I began my talk by saying, I believe that God did indeed create everything on earth in 6 literal days. But I want to share with you the Hebrew word for day has 4 different literal definitions. So I have no problem signing a doctrinal statement that I believe God did it in 6 literal days. Because one of those definitions is a long but finite period of time.
Right.
And says, all you got to say is, you don't have to know any Hebrew. Says, a lot of you here don't know Hebrew. But just read Genesis 1:1 to Genesis 2:4. You're going to see that word day used 3 different definitions. So I shared with them. Creation day 1, it's days and nights. So it says that's the literal definition of Yom as the daylight hours. You go to creation day 4, and it talks about seasons, days, and years. It says, there you got the 24 hours. You go to Genesis 2:4, it uses the word day to refer to the entire creation period. There is your long but finite period of time. Mm-hmm. And so what you need to do is look at the 6 days of creation, not just in the context of Genesis 1, but in the context of the entire Bible, to see which of those three literal definitions. If I said, no, there's a fourth one, it means part of the daylight hours. But that definition is not used in Genesis 1. So it says, let's go through the entire Bible and see which of the literal options gives you the best defense of biblical inerrancy. Mm-hmm. Now, that had a huge impact on that audience. There were some who said, we're not convinced, but there were a whole bunch that were.
Was the speaker convinced?
The guy who was debating did agree to another debate, because one of the questions that came up after the debate was over, they said, well, Hugh, didn't you debate Jason Lyle on national television? I says, yes. And wasn't part of that debate about the moon and why you thought the moon proved that the universe was old and he thought it proved that it was only 24 hours? And you asked him if he'd be willing to defend his view in front of astronomers that knew the technical details? Because that was a frustration in that televised debate. It was in front of lay people, and he was bringing up astrophysics that was way beyond the audience. So I says, hey, if you really want to push this argument, let's do it in front of astronomers. Well, for the next 3 years, I kept giving him invitations to actually do that in front of astronomers. And he says, well, I'll only do it if all the astronomers are Christian. I said, no problem. He says, well, we'll do it in front of astronomers that both you and I believe are actual evangelicals. And I said, well, I'll only do it if none of them are Darwinists. And I said, I'll go along with that too. I called all of his bluffs. Then he said, I'm too busy. And I said, well, how about if we schedule it 5 years from now? I'm sure there's an opening in your calendar 5 years from now. He says, I'm booked for the next decade. So, now I know he wasn't, because I wound up doing another debate with him. But there were people in that audience that said to Danny Faulkner, hey, Jason Lyle won't do this debate. Will you do it? And he said, I will. And he kept his word. We actually did do a debate in front of astronomers. And I was pleased because I thought that Danny Faulkner was more competent than Jason Lyle to defend the young Earth position. And we have the entire debate recorded as it was on television. And it was done in front of a panel of 13 evangelical astronomers. And they were also brought on the TV show to evaluate the debate. And I'll tell you a humorous story. I said, okay, we selected you to evaluate our debate, but we want you to do what the Jerusalem Council did. They listened to Paul and Barnabas, and they listened to people who thought circumcision was essential for Christian to be a Christian. The Jerusalem elders listened to the debate, and they produced a letter where they evaluated the debate. It says, we want you to do the same thing. And, you know, so they said, yeah, we can do that. They produced a 41-page document, not including the citations of the scientific and theological literature. I said, you know, the Jerusalem Council was able to condense it down to two sentences. So I said, see if you can get it down to one page, because we want this to be something that will be useful to lay people, not just to PhD astrophysicists. It took them 18 months to edit it down to one page. They said it was the hardest thing they've ever done to get it down to one page. But I'll tell you, what they wrote was beautifully done. And it's up on our website. All you got to do is put into our search engine, astronomer statement, it'll pop up. It's also in my book, A Matter of Days. So, and I think it's a great example on how we can resolve other church-splitting issues. Get the two sides together, get a faithful group to evaluate it and to produce a letter. So I've been suggesting, hey, we've been able to do this for the young Earth, old Earth issue. Why can't we do it for marriage and divorce? Why can't we do it for the gender issues that are splitting the church?
Well, I want to thank you all for coming. I want to invite you, the ones that are new, there's plenty of new people here tonight, and welcome. Thank you for being here. On every Sunday at 11 o'clock in this room, we do Paradox Sunday School class, and Dr. Ross, when he's not on the road traveling the world, He is the teacher. And then every month, on the first Monday of the month, we have the Los Angeles Reasons to Believe chapter meeting in this room at 7 o'clock, first Monday. Now, this first Monday coming up happens to be July 4th. So in July, it's going to be the second Monday, the 11th at 7 o'clock. But normally, it is the first Monday. So if you want any more information about either of those two events, come up and see me, and I'll be glad to give you the particulars. So let's give Dr. Ross a big hand. Thank you all very much for coming. And again, Hugh, would you close us in prayer, please?
Sure.
Father in heaven, again, we want to thank you for giving us time. Time is our most valuable possession. And thank you, Lord, for the opportunity to gather together like this. And Father, I pray that you would keep us motivated to pursue our questions, our doubts. You're big enough to handle all of our questions, all of our issues. And help us, Lord, to pursue you for the answers we need to live the life that you want us to lead. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.